Welcome to the Project Zion podcast. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts the Restoration offers for today's world. We aim to feature a variety of guests with roots in the Restoration tradition from Community of Christ and our friends from The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. The music has been provided by Ben Howington. You can find his music at mormonguitar.com.
I'm here with my friend Brittany Mangelson, who is a recent convert to the Community of Christ. Hi, Brittany.
Hi, Nancy and Rob. Thanks for having me.
And we've got our co-host Rob here as ever. Hi, Rob.
Hi, and welcome back, everyone, to Faith Transitions.
Okay, so let's just dive right in then. Brittany, I'm wondering if you can tell me a little bit about your early life and what your family was like and how faith played a role in your family.
Yeah, so I grew up in Provo, Utah. I was born and raised there, just a few miles or maybe even just a mile south of BYU. And my dad was a convert to the LDS Church, and my mom's family goes back to the days of Kirtland. And we were pretty typical. I come from a family of five kids. I'm second to youngest. We attended church every Sunday. My dad served in various bishoprics and state callings, and we were active and typical, and we didn't have any big bumps in the road as far as, you know, all of us kids were pretty straight arrow. None of us were really rebellious. We were pretty idyllic from you know, what you would expect your typical LDS family to be.
And can you tell us a little bit then about the practice of Mormonism, like within your family? Did you pray? Did you read scriptures? Was there a particular thing that your parents emphasized within your home?
So we would have family prayers every night. Our kids are, my siblings were kind of spread out, as far as ages go. So we had teenagers all the way to newborn babies, and there were five of us. And so scheduling was kind of crazy. And my dad, he had a wild schedule. So, you know, consistent family scripture study, you know, that happened at the same time every day wasn't necessarily something that was, something that, you know, happened all the time, but when it did happen, we were serious about it, and we definitely did pray every night together. And you know, my parents were always ready and eager to answer any gospel questions we had. You know, we were involved. My brothers were involved with scouting. We did personal progress and faith in God, and you know, all the programs that the church has for the youth. We were all really heavily involved in all of that. So the church definitely was part of our everyday life at home as well.
Okay. And what about friendship relationships? You talk about growing up in Provo, so most of our listeners can probably assume, but could you also describe the greater region within, you know, your surroundings that you grew up?
Yeah, so everyone I knew was Mormon. Our ward had a lot of youth that were my age and, you know, the age of my siblings. There were three other girls that were born within 2 weeks of me in our ward. And so we you know, it was a huge support group. And so I had, you know, friends at church were also my friends at school, and the friends at school that weren't in my ward were still all LDS. I did BYU Children's Dance Program from the time I was three all the way up through high school. And so I had, you know, friends at dance that were also LDS. And so really every aspect of my life, it was just encompassed by Mormonism.
Right, right. So really no exposure to anything but that paradigm at that time.
Yeah, no. And I remember I have grandparents who live in Southern California, and I would remember going there, going to Disneyland, and almost pitying everyone around me because I thought, you know, I had this little Mormon arrogance about me, I guess, that I don't know if arrogance is the right word, but I wanted to, you know, share the gospel with everyone. And I knew that we had the truth and that the world out there, you know, it kind of frightened me a little bit because it's all I knew. It was the language I spoke. It was the food I ate, the community I lived in. It was everything to me.
And at what age was this? I mean, I'm just curious. That's pretty striking that at a very young, I'm assuming, age, you go to Disneyland, you look around and go, oh, these poor people.
Yeah, I mean, it was probably elementary school, wow, you know, okay, in my primary days of just recognizing that we were different and yeah, kind of that narrative of, you know, being the chosen generation and,
right,
and you know, how special are you to be born at this time and in an LDS home. That was very, very ingrained in me. And I don't know if that necessarily came from my family or from church or, you know, all of right, the above, right, but... And then also being like pioneer stock, you know, that was something to be proud of too. And so, yeah, it just was everything right to me. So,
and did that feel good? Like, did that just feel, you know, I mean, how did that feel to just be kind of surrounded by Mormonism? And, you know, was it a good childhood and growing up? What was that like?
Yeah, I really liked it. I felt safe. I knew that, there was, I guess, just kind of this automatic trust between my friends and my parents' friends and even teachers at school. You know, like you would just kind of know that they were LDS, or they would, you know, make some comment that they would, you know, some comment about church or something or their calling. And there was just this kind of like underlining, we are the same and it's awesome and we're like living in Zion, it almost felt like, in, you know, little Provo, Utah.
Right, right. And I guess I'm just wondering, it's probably a little bit of a side tangent, but you're talking about people signaling to one another membership. And I'm wondering, I almost wonder the opposite too. Is it just sometimes taken for granted in such a homogenous culture, surrounding environment that everyone is? Or is there a lot of signaling going on? Does that make sense? It's kind of a tangent, but I just, since you brought that up, I'm curious.
No, yeah. Well, it's kind of interesting, I guess, now being on the outside of that. It's something that I've faced and I kind of second guess everything.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, now whenever I see, you know, a tank top at the grocery store or something, I'm like, hey,
right.
even if I'm not wearing a tank top.
Right.
But yeah, I don't know. I think that here in Utah, and especially, you know, Utah County, it just is so part of the culture and the identity of the community that I don't think that people actually realize it. I think, you know, when you go to Disneyland and you're wearing your BYU cap, you know, I think that that might be a more intentional way of signaling.
Right.
But, you know, if your high school student's talking about the big game on Friday night and you know that it's the BYU game and they come in with, you know, drive into the parking lot with their BYU flags on their car, you know, it's just like, it's just the identity of who everybody is. So,
right,
and when
right,
you're a part of that, it's, it feels good. So.
And is that and pretty, go ahead, Nancy. Go ahead.
No, I was going to move us on, but do yeah, you have still have,
no, I was just going to say, essentially move us on and say, was that what it was like all through school, up through all of your primary education in high school?
Yeah, I would say so. I was heavily involved in, you know, seminary. I graduated, you know, release time seminary. So it was part of our curriculum. You know, we would, our seminary building was on, I guess, technically off school property, but just up the parking lot.
Right.
And it was, you know, you'd plan your schedule around it and everything. And, I was really involved with girls camp. I was class president of My Made Beehive and Laurel, all the classes, you know, it was, yeah, it just continued to be a very big part of my life.
Okay. Where are first challenges then? I'm getting maybe too ahead of myself, and maybe we can bury the lead a little bit, talk about folks you meet along the way and how that influences you. But you are obviously, we led with a little bit of an introduction that you've certainly left the community now that you grew up in. Where do first challenges maybe come before we get to that?
Yeah, so early on, I guess, right around the same time, I remember being a little girl and just realizing that being a girl in the church meant something different than being a boy. And I remember watching my brothers pass the sacrament on Sunday and just having this deep sadness almost that I would never be able to participate in that. And then learning about God from a very male perspective and a male narrative, while at the same time being told that I could, as a woman, become like God and even become God, but yet my gender was so much part of me. And so I was missing Heavenly Mother, essentially. And I didn't understand why I wasn't able to pray to her or why we weren't able to learn about her. And this started at a very young age. I mean, I was in primary when I started questioning this. And I remember going to my mom and asking, and her answers were fine. You know, they were what you would expect, just that, you know, she's too sacred. We don't talk about her. She hasn't been revealed to us yet. And so it kind of, I think that that was probably my first memory of like me wanting something more than what was being offered to me. And so that was when I just started questioning things, not even questioning, just being aware of that there was something not right within myself and in relationship to the church, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
And did that develop as you grew, or was it just kind of a low-level concern?
No, it grew. And it grew into more, I guess, practical ways, maybe less abstract of, you know, some gendered God in, you know, wherever God is. But it manifests itself in ways that really actually meant something to me. Like in seminary and high school, all of our CES employees were men, except for, I think it was my junior year, they finally hired a female staff member. And I was so excited because I'm a very visual learner, and I like, well, I guess I had decided that I was really dedicated to the church and I wanted to be involved, but there was just no example of what that looked like. I felt like I was at the mercy of a bishop constantly. There was no real avenue to say, you know, I want to do this and be devoted to the church. And so to have a female CES teacher was kind of that example and that role model of somebody who had decided that she was going to take this path and go on it. And so that was, I guess, kind of a beacon of hope in this struggle that I had with gender and religion. But it was something that was definitely bubbling and causing me to question, but yet I didn't want to question it too much because, you know, there's too much at stake if you let your mind go down that path.
Yeah.
So were you,
go ahead.
I was just wondering, were you aware then that of questions, like questions about gender that were off limits?
I mean, not really. Like, so I didn't really know what feminism was. I had a very naive, I guess, perspective of what human sexuality was. So the idea that, you know, someone could be gay or someone could be feminist or things like that just weren't even really on my radar. Mm-hmm. And I certainly didn't think that either of those things would jive with the gospel plan because, you know, everything is so entrenched in gender roles and things. And to me, that was the gospel. And so, it was just kind of this subtle thing that was kind of developing within myself, probably before I even realized, you know, what was happening, I guess.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I actually was, when I was thinking to ask a question, and Nancy essentially asked the same thing I was thinking, was how, you know, how reactions were. You said your mother addressed the question about your seeking of the feminine divine, was that we haven't had revelation clear enough yet to make that clear. So you had that, which sounds like she was okay to talk to you about that. But were there people that you would take questions to that you didn't receive support from? Or maybe if not, why did you not go ask those questions? And then part B, the other thing I wanted to have you ask, I know it was a lot at once, but did you find all of these answers that you did you find them satisfying?
Yeah. Okay. So No, I don't really think that I opened myself up to a lot of people. I felt very alone, I guess. Everyone around me was okay with talking about God in, you know, with male pronouns. My mom had let me know that, you know, she was okay with not really knowing about Heavenly Mother, and certainly she would welcome any revelation or any new information about her, but it wasn't something that she really got hung up on. It didn't really affect her. I think I did confide in that female seminary teacher that I mentioned, and she kind of said the same thing. I agreed with them, you know, on one level I agreed with them. It didn't seem like it affected me, but at the same time it was puzzling because it really affected me if I was going to become a god someday. I mean, and if my gender was so important, then shouldn't I know what the female god is doing? You know, why should my example always be the masculine divine? And so, so I guess I just kind of learned to, stifle myself and not really question and almost not trust myself in my questions, because everybody around me was fine with the narrative that they had been told. And so I just thought, well, okay, something's wrong with me, so I'll just be quiet and listen and try to figure it out on my own. So I didn't really open up to a lot of people, actually.
And I think a lot of people probably can empathize with that, at least folks who struggle with questions on some level. And it's fascinating to me because on the one hand, you have in the Mormon tradition, there's a very strong language about asking and you'll receive and seek and you shall find. And the example of Joseph Smith reading the scripture that says, if you ask, I'll give you answers. But then on the other hand, there are, like your experience, you talk about having a lot of questions, but not finding that you can even knock on the door to get the answer. How do you reconcile that? How do you think maybe we'll do some psychological guesswork? How does that work for somebody like your mom or your seminary teacher, but not for you ultimately?
I think that's the million-dollar question. And I continually have asked myself this. My faith journey has taken me to all sorts of questions that go beyond the feminine divine. And sometimes I feel like a crazy person because I just want to literally shout from my rooftops, how does this not bother anyone else?
Right.
And I wonder, you know, if I'm just being cynical or looking for the negative or looking for the bad. But I think that people really like certainty. And I think that because Mormonism has so much to offer, it has so much to take away. And we'll probably get to this, but I held on for a really long time when I probably shouldn't have. And it was all based on fear. And I didn't want to lose that community, and I didn't want to let myself go down this road that I was being pulled towards because I was so afraid at what I had to lose. And so I'm not saying that, you know, everybody ignores their questions out of fear, but I know for me, when I was ignoring my questions, it was very much fear-based.
Mm. And this starts even at this point, it sounded like. Is that true? I mean, is that fair for me to say that in this high school phase where you're starting to test questions, the fear starts at this time too?
Yeah. And I think that, you know, right around that time, I wasn't quite sure if I bought into the one true church narrative. Instead of going to Disneyland and almost pitying these people, I would, you know, go and see at Disneyland or wherever, the world, that it just seemed so open and new and exciting and vibrant. And it wasn't like I kind of switched in a, you know, I'm almost looking down on you, or I want to lift you up to my level, to just being curious about everything that was out there. And I think for me, when I started allowing myself to do that, just the concept of a one true church and the ultimate authority in a very literal sense just kind of started chipping away slowly. Mm. Although I still did hold on to it, but I think I didn't allow myself to really explore that because of the fear. Mm. You know, well, what if this is the one true church? I can't deny that. I can't, you know, lose my family forever. And so I just kind of buried everything, you know, started putting things on my shelf, I guess, that then slowly collected things over time.
Right. So how long, keep going then. You're starting to put things on the shelf And for those not familiar with that imagery, I keep hearing that a lot lately. The idea, and I think Bill, as we talked to him just recently, talked about that his shelf collapsed and finally collapsed when he was a bishop. So there's this phenomenon, I guess, probably in fundamental traditions in general, not just Mormonism, that as issues come up that challenge sort of that fundamental belief, that rather than dealing with it, you kind of file it away and put it up on a shelf to deal with later, or maybe just the shelf do not look at. So you're putting more things on this shelf as you're going along. Keep talking about that. Your high school, how does post high school and all of that start to continue to add to the shelf?
Yeah, so I didn't really have a desire to go to BYU, Brigham Young University, for several reasons, but you know, a big one was that it was so close to home and I wanted to branch out a little bit. And so I had a sister who was up at USU, Utah State University, which was 2 hours away. And so I headed up there after high school and was still very active LDS, completely believing. I was involved in the singles ward a lot. As a Relief Society teacher, I did the enrichment committee, and I was a ward missionary, and still continued to go to church every Sunday. My roommates were all LDS, and it was still, you know, that continuation of that community, that tribe, that camaraderie that you feel with these people that you love and are comfortable with. But I was a sociology major. And it was this weird paradox of kind of learning about society as you know, a greater thing than just my little worldview. And also, we talked a lot about patriarchy and how that, you know, affects different institutions on a personal level and on a, you know, a micro and a macro level. And, you know, world things like the world economy and, you know, when women went to women have always worked, but when, you know, we admit that women started going back to work and how that played into gender roles and all these things that, you know, I had been interested in, but kind of rubbed up against my faith community a little bit and the traditional gender roles that I had been brought up with. And, the LDS church is very patriarchal and men and women have their different divine roles. And it was hard for me because I was learning to critically analyze societal structures and institutions, but I wasn't really able to do that on my church and still have full harmony within myself. And I certainly didn't feel like I could raise any of these issues, vocally. And so I guess I was just more of a little budding feminist, and I mean, at this time I knew what a feminist was, but I didn't see how it had any place within Mormonism, because I was still trying to split this is the world and how the world does things, and then this is God's kingdom, and I guess that this society is how it's supposed to be. And so even though I was seeing all these benefits of, you know, like an egalitarian system or, you know, whatever on one end, I was still trying to just make the church work and just not think about any of my doubts on that level.
So if I can ask then just for a little bit of the other side of this, so as you're a young adult, as you're at Utah State University, are there things that are really working, you know, for you at church? You know, you're part of your very much an integral part of your young single adult ward. You know, if that's what's difficult, what is working at this time?
Yeah. So I loved the community. I loved a lot of the theology too. I mean, as much as I struggled with the concept of, you know, what happens after death and how do we become gods, I found a lot of beauty in it. I almost felt like, you know, Mormonism has this really awesome feminist theology of like, you know, we have a female God that is equal to the male God. And I really banked on that. And I don't want to say excited to become a god, but I was excited at the thought of that maybe that would be a possibility, or even just to like explore that theology, it was exciting. And I was, you know, dating boys and excited about getting married. And I had, you know, it wasn't an option to not get married in the temple. So I definitely still had a very deep belief in Mormonism. And it was, I mean, for the most part, it was good. And I think that if you would have asked anyone who I was around, any of my roommates, any of my family members, you know, none of them would have seen what was kind of stewing within me coming at all. Because, yeah, for the most part, I was fully active. We would go to the temple, Logan Temple, and do baptisms for the dead as roommates. And we were, yeah, very involved. And it was an exciting time to, you know, kind of be on the brink of that place where, you know, you're free and you could, I mean, I could have experimented with things or, you know, started drinking or whatever, because I was not at a church school. And so it wasn't like the rules of my school were keeping me in line or the rules of my church. I mean, it really was my choice. And I loved it. You know, it was what worked for me.
Right. Right. And I want to follow up. You said, as you were examining or exploring feminism for the first time, that you said you couldn't find a place for it within the LDS tradition as you had viewed it at that time. And you specifically mentioned that you tried to keep those two things separate a little bit. Why did you think you couldn't find a place at that time for feminism within Mormonism? And what does that mean, I think, maybe for you at that time, the separation?
Well, because I think, I don't know. I think that how I perceived feminism, and I guess maybe I still do. It was the only thing that I could critique was male dominated spaces. Right. And so for me, it just seemed like the biggest oxymoron to be considered a Mormon feminist, because if you were still trying to work within the paradigm of the LDS church, you still had to play by their rules.
Right.
And I mean, and that sounds kind of negative, because at the time, I mean, it wasn't their rules. It was God's rules, you know? And so things like women's ordination weren't even necessarily on my mind. I mean, I'm talking about like, you know, do I want to go into something that will lead to a fruitful career?
Right.
Or do I just want to get a degree and find a husband so he can support me and I'll fall back on my degree if I need to? You know, I mean, so it was like entry level feminism, I guess. But it still was not something that I was comfortable with exploring with my faith. I mean, I didn't have a lot of aspirations to, you know, go beyond just getting a degree just for the sake of getting a degree, because I knew what my role was. I knew that I was supposed to get married and have children and be home with them.
Yeah.
So anything outside of that was just really scary.
Mm. Yeah. 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 Thanks for, you know, commenting on that. I just wondered. Yeah. Okay. So keep going. I didn't mean to derail you into that again. I just was curious how that separation, that's a lot of anxiety to carry about those two things.
Mm-hmm.
And you said entry level feminism, but I think that's pretty important and foundational stuff to be, at least to point out the fact that the institution itself is so limiting that it defines for you what the boundaries of a role are. And I think that's pretty significant by itself. So anyway, so college, keep going. You're dating boys. Maybe let's get up to that point.
Yeah. So, I guess my sophomore year is when I met my husband, and we dated for a year and a half and got married. And he was someone who had been on his mission a little bit later. He didn't go until he was 21. And he had kind of been through his own faith crisis and period of doubt. Then, you know, came back strong, went on a mission. He served in Mexico. And we were Mormon. I mean, I guess it's interesting to me, because I look at, you know, where we are now and I think back and I think like, wow, we really were Mormon. You know, we never got in trouble. We never did things that we shouldn't. We just dated for a year and then got engaged and then got married. And we got married in the temple. And going to the temple was kind of a really interesting experience for me. I guess, you know, I had had this vision of Heavenly Mother in the back of my mind for so long. And also, you're taught, you know, as a young Mormon, that you don't talk about the temple because it's sacred. It will be, you know, revealed and presented to you in the right time. And I kind of felt like those two descriptions and those two narratives went hand in hand. And so, and I also knew that in the temple, you know, the little that I did know about it, I knew that you figured out your role more, and that it talked about the eternities, and it, you know, I had heard people say that things were made clear to them about the next life and things like that. And so in the back of my mind, I just kind of had this thought of, great, you know, this is where we learn about Heavenly Mother. That's why my mom didn't want to talk about it, is because she learned about it in the temple and it was too sacred to talk about with me. Yeah. And so, so I went, and my husband had prepared me a little bit of, you know, what was going to happen and what was going down. And I mean, I took temple prep and everything, and I was an institute student, and so I felt like I was pretty prepared. And when it was all said and done, I just thought, wait, what? How did I miss what I was coming for? Like, where is Heavenly Mother? Because I genuinely thought I was going to learn about her and that it would be explicit. Mm. And I mean, I understand that the temple is very sacred, and I don't mean to, you know, I had good experiences there. But I was really let down because the narrative continued to be male dominated. And I just thought, so is that what my role is to become invisible? And, cause that's what it felt like. And I know that there are parts in the temple that are very, empowering to women. You know, a few specific things come to mind, and I would lean on those things, and I found beauty in them. But overall, it just almost felt, you know, like the dagger was just pushed into my heart even more. Because I so badly was craving just this visual example of what my role was going to be. And I just felt like I was missing a huge part of my identity that just was never presented to me. And so the one time that I was certain that it was going to come, it just fell completely flat. But we got married and continued to go to the temple and do the things that Mormons do. And, you know, we were still active in the church and everything like that. So it didn't, like, the temple wasn't my breaking point. It was just kind of a disappointment, I guess.
That sounds really difficult, because the temple is built up so much in Mormon discussion, as being like at this kind of pinnacle of spiritual experience, and then to have it not be that thing must have been tremendously disappointing.
Yeah. And I didn't feel like I really had anyone to talk to. I mean, my husband, he's great and sees, you know, things from my perspective a lot more now. But when we were first married, it wasn't on his radar at all, those kind of things. And I was one of the first friends that I had to get married. And so not very many of my friends had been endowed. And even those that did, you know, you're not really supposed to talk about it. And so it just, I didn't know where to go. And it didn't feel right to, like, talk to my male bishop about it. That just didn't really seem right. And so I just kind of, again, quietly turned into myself and, I guess spiritually moped about it. I don't know if that's a good description, but that's what it felt like. So
what I was going to say just quickly was to empathize with you is my experience. When I went to the LDS temple for the first time, I had this, I don't know if the same issues were particularly catalyzing for me, but it was a very depressing overall experience. And just when Nancy had just said just a minute ago, I don't know that I'd ever reflected in these terms, but you said it was, you know, we put a lot of expectation on that experience as this pinnacle of spirituality, and not to have that happen. I guess I can empathize with you, Brittany, that it was a big letdown for me too. And I actually came out of it freaked out. I came out going, what? I don't remember any of this building up to this. How is this what we're about now? I can appreciate your struggle. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting because, you know, I've found recently, you know, some things from my young woman's days and my personal progress book. And I found some stuff from girls camp and just looking at how much of it is temple centric.
Right.
And, you know, and I understand that people really love the endowment and love that. And,
right.
and I think that's great. But I also, it just kind of reminded me of, you know, this hope that I had so strongly before I went, and then just kind of this flood of, you know, and it's hard because the temple usually comes at a very important time of your life. You're usually preparing for a mission or it's right before you get married, you know, and not in all cases, but those are the two most common. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if you have this spiritual panic attack, you know, how are you supposed to process that right before you go on a mission or right before you get married? I mean, mm-hmm. it's just a really vulnerable, very vulnerable time in your life. And so you're just kind of like thrust into it. And I just kept waiting for someone to, like, you know, throw me a lifeboat or something. Right. Yeah, I just was like, someone explain this to me.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
and it just never came. So,
well, I empathize completely.
So then, so you have this very difficult experience in the temple. You're married now. How do you move forward from that?
Denial, I think. So, you know, and like, so like I said, my husband had kind of had his own faith crisis, you know, years before. And so I kind of thought that I was almost marrying someone that was, you know, immune to another faith crisis. Cause he had already got that bug out of his system. And I was really leaning on him to, you know, essentially be my spiritual rock, my priesthood rock. And I mean, he's a great guy and he was, you know, very faithful, very valiant. We continued to go to the temple. You know, we were students, poor students. So the temple was kind of a good, cheap date night. And so we would go and I would let him know very bluntly what I was uncomfortable with and what I was comfortable with. And he was fully supportive with that. We just continued to try to figure it out together. About a year after we were married, I found out I was pregnant with twins. And so that kind of rocked my world in more ways than one. I think maybe that's where some of my resentment started with this idea that I felt like I had almost been cheated, because all of my identity was going to be in motherhood and it came a little bit quicker than I anticipated. I was 22 when I gave birth to them.
Wow. Yeah.
And so, I didn't have my degree yet. And it wasn't like I was, you know, really ambitious to go get a job, but like I needed that degree in case I needed to fall back on it, you know? And, not to say that I hate motherhood or, you know, was resentful of motherhood, but just kind of resentful of this role that I felt like other people had envisioned for me and I wasn't necessarily ready for it, but yet like cultural pressures were just so strong. I mean, if you're Mormon and you don't have a kid after a year, people are like, hey, what's going on? You know, and there's just a lot of social pressure. So my husband continued and got his degree. We were at Barnes & Noble one day and he had opened up a book randomly and it was a book on masonry and it looked very similar to what we do in the temple. And I think that was kind of the start of like his second faith crisis. I don't know, maybe I'm getting ahead of myself, but I was not very supportive of his exploration, I guess, trying to figure out the endowment. Even though I had my own issues with it, he went on this several year long study to try to make the connections between Masonry and Mormonism. And he read everything. He read things from Mormon perspectives, anti-Mormon, you know, and I put anti-Mormon in quotes, but, and he, you know, read things from just, you know, very scholarly that had nothing to do with Mormonism, just, you know, purely Masonic things. And he was trying really hard to, I guess, save it.
His faith.
Save his faith.
And you were scared, though, it sounds like you said.
Yeah, he would, you know, bring home all these books from the library, and I was just like, "Are you serious, dude? Like, don't go down this road." I wasn't overly supportive of it, because it was scary. It was that fear kicking in, I guess.
So what do you? So what happens then? How do you continue to respond? How does he progress through his exploration and study?
Yeah, so he, from there, and it really was not like a one issue thing. I mean, it was a very, very long process that took, you know, 2-3+ years. But we just kind of started running into just the classic Mormon faith crisis things. Questions about the historicity of the Book of Mormon popped up, and you know, different versions of the first vision and the Kirtland banking scandal and all these things that, you know, weren't brought into our Sunday experience with Mormonism. Mm-hmm. And it kind of questioned this sanitized version of history that we had been taught. And I was trying my best to ignore it. And my husband, he works graves, and he would, you know, go to work and listen to, you know, 10 hours of John DeLynn in a row and come back with all these questions. And I would just try to sweep it under the rug and not worry about it too much. All the while I have, you know, newborn twins, and I went back to school pretty immediately after they were born. And so I was trying to find this identity with two babies and school and faith crisis. And it was just kind of a joke. Like, it was a mess. It was an absolute mess. Yeah.
Sheesh. Are you still in Provo during all of this time?
No.
I mean, Utah State. I don't know why I keep thinking, I was thinking Provo, but yeah, I mean, Utah State, you're still in Logan during all of this.
For the most part. We moved down to Utah County when my girls were about 2 months old. So that was another kind of shift. I'd lived in Logan for, you know, 4 years at that point.
Right.
I had a job. I had, you know, my own little new community up there. And so then being ripped apart from my support system and my ward, who was great up in Logan, to this new ward that nobody knew us. And, you know, we had two tiny babies, and it was, and I was doing school online. So it was just a juggle, and I didn't feel like I had a lot of support. And so I think the community aspect of the church started to die, which was what was really keeping me in and keeping me, you know, wanting to be part of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it reminds me of something John Larson said on Mormon Expression a couple of years ago. You either stay because the community serves you or the theology does. And if one of the, you know, if they both break down, that's not enough anymore. So
yeah.
Wow. Okay. So how do you push through all that?
Well, I don't want to like throw my husband under the bus because, you know, truthfully,
he's not here throwing.
Well, and that's kind of the funny thing. I feel like people that are closest to me think that it was Josh that kind of, you know, led us astray.
Right,
and then people closest to him think that it was my fault and my feminism and, you know, but it truly was just this tornado, like two tornadoes that were kind of side by side. And whenever we would like collide and actually agree on something that was like against the church, we would kind of freak out and be like, "Oh no, like we're good. We're Mormon, you know?"
Right.
So, polygamy, I guess, was my biggest breaking point. So all the while, you know, we're learning about the Book of Mormon and we're learning about the, you know, Nephites and Lamanites and trying to figure out if that's historically accurate and, you know, just really try to put legitimacy to the restoration. And I came across polygamy stuff and my mind was blown. I had no idea how intense polygamy was and how horrific it was. And, you know, I had grown up with the narrative. I come from polygamous ancestors and I knew their stories. You know, I knew that they were happy. I knew that, you know, like whoever sister, wife, whatever was a widow. And so like, you know, you strongly play off that narrative of like, this is for the widows and whatever. But really being faced with the evidence of how polygamy started, who it started with, that was a shock to me. And so I guess that in my mind with feminine divine things and with my concerns about the one true church narrative, they were just kind of all peaking and coming to this apex. And my husband, you know, was on his own journey, and polygamy bothered him. But for him, coming to the conclusion for himself that the Book of Mormon is not a historical document was kind of what pushed him over the edge. And all the while, you know, things are happening like Prop 8 and, you know, ordained women and, you know, obviously over the course of several years, but these, mm-hmm. these things that were seen more as like social issues, that I was kind of like, well, you know, from a sociological stance, you know, I get you guys, but again, this is the Lord's church. And so I was still trying to split things in my mind, like even, you know, just a couple of years ago I was, but once I figured out how much of my beliefs and theology and all these things that I'd been wrestling with, like Heavenly Mother, when I realized how deeply rooted in polygamy those things were, I was just able to like dramatically let it all go. And it was kind of alarming. And I think, you know, different books like In Sacred Loneliness, and I haven't read it cover to cover, but the Year of Polygamy podcast was a big part in that breakdown. But I mean, at the same time, I wouldn't say that that was like, you know, the reason why I left. It just kind of, I guess, allowed me to really say that church leaders have made mistakes. And then I kind of got the courage to start naming those mistakes and, you know, rejecting things that went against who I knew God to be. Mm.
Yeah.
But all the while, we were still active Mormons.
Wow, okay. Yeah, so what's that like? Describe what that's like to be in church and to be in such turmoil internally.
It feels very dishonest. By this point, we had bought a house where we live now, and we live in a really great neighborhood. We still live here. It's very, very LDS. We're back in Utah County, so it's less diverse than when we lived in Salt Lake or even Logan. And it's hard because that whole community was, again, really, really strong. And I remember, you know, when Ordained Women launched, and, you know, by this point I had pretty much lost my, you know, pure childlike faith in the institution. But at the same time, I thought, like, Mormonism is my tribe. We're going to keep going with it. These are my people. So Ordained Women popped up, and I thought, like, wow, you know, look, how brave are these women? And I was too afraid to get involved, even though I was supportive 100%. I just didn't know what it would do to my reputation, to my family. It was too scary. And so I just quietly watched from the sidelines, and I would read comments, you know, on Facebook or whatever, and I would just see the hatred that was being spewed towards these women that were just asking a question or just standing in line or wearing pants to church, you know? And I thought, is this really the community I want to be part of? I mean, shouldn't we be mourning with these women and supporting them and sustaining them and upholding them and sending them love and light? And instead, you know, we're just thrashing them to pieces. And, you know, I mean, literally, publicly, just, it just was barbaric and horrifying. And then, you know, more recently, you know, what the church has been doing to the LGBT population. And so I guess it got to a point where, I would sit through church, and I was a primary teacher actually when we left, and I would sit and look at these lessons that were so oversimplified, and I would try to say, like, okay, Brittany, you're teaching 7-year-olds. It obviously has to be simple. But yet I would find like a blatant lie or, you know, a blatant omission of a huge historical thing or whatever in the manual, and I would just freak out of, how am I supposed to teach my kids the full comprehensive story when they're being taught from such a young age one narrative that I disagree with so much? And so it was really depressing. I would literally come home from church and just cry. And, you know, especially if my husband wasn't able to go to church because of his work schedule, you know, he would ask me how it was, and I would just wail and weep, and I don't know how we're gonna do this. But I was still determined to make it work.
So how long did that go on?
About a year, maybe a year and a half. And I don't think anybody really knew. They knew that my husband was struggling because he was more vocal and he was not in primary. So he would, you know, make comments in gospel doctrine that would ruffle feathers and things. And, and he wasn't trying to be antagonistic. Like sometimes he would just say like, oh yeah, I forgot. Like Mormons don't know about that or Mormons don't believe that or, you know, whatever. And so I feel like people kind of really assumed that like this faith struggle was his own, but I was not opening up to anybody about it because I was too afraid.
You hadn't shut him out, had you?
No. I mean, at different points in our journey I had, and I definitely was not as fair to him as I should have been. And, you know, I accused him of looking at anti-Mormon literature and everything. And I mean, things were really rocky for a while.
Yeah,
I mean, it just, it got to the point that I was right there where he was. And it was not just like one or two questions that could be explained by, you know, a bishop or something. We didn't feel it was like the entire foundation is sitting on sand. What do we do with it?
So what then, how do you go from that particular state to leaving or to breaking or to contemplating leaving?
Yeah, so I had a baby in March of 2014. And so my husband kind of, well, so he's heavily involved in like all the Facebook Mormon groups. And he had run across John Hamer online. And, you know, in our faith journey, we just kind of started looking at all fractions of Mormonism, not to try to join them, but just to kind of see what happened and try to get a more comprehensive view of what was going on. And so, Josh started talking to John Hamer, and I think that, you know, he had paid attention to some of his blog posts. I don't think at the time John really had a lot of like podcasts. I mean, I think maybe he had a few podcasts, but he didn't have as much material online as he does now.
Right.
Can we just note that John Hamer is the church historian for the Community of Christ?
Yeah, I don't think that he's the official historian, but he is a historian who has, yeah, done a ton of work. And he's an LDS convert as well. And he's like the master of the restoration. Like he knows so much about all the different breakoffs. And I mean, breakoffs not of the LDS church, but of the original church that, you know, really no longer exists, like all the fractions. And yeah, he's done a lot of work for the LDS church as well, as far as Joseph Smith papers and things like that.
Right.
So he knows this stuff. So we started, Josh started communicating with John Hamer, and there was this little Latter-day Seeker group in Salt Lake that was going. And Josh got the information about that. And this was, you know, the fall before. And he just kind of sat on it and quietly watched things and from the internet, you know, and tried to figure out where Community of Christ, you know, stood now and how literal they take things and different things like that. And so then when I had my baby, you know, you're free, I guess, to take a few weeks or months off of church, however long you deem necessary. I took quite a long time off church, but he took advantage of that time and decided to take, you know, my twins up to Salt Lake to go check out Community of Christ while I stayed home with the baby. And I was honestly not very happy about it at first. I thought, you know, either we do the Mormonism thing or we don't do religion. Like I really wasn't in a mindset to like find another religion.
Yeah.
And I really was confused at like, okay, so Josh, if you think that Joseph Smith wrote the Book of Mormon or, you know, whatever, if you think that the first vision didn't really happen, you know, the way that we had always been taught, you know, what are you doing investigating a church that was started by Joseph Smith? Like
right,
it was just awkward. Like it just felt really weird. And so he went a couple times and they had these seeker lessons and classes once a month. And so I think he went in April and then he went again in May. And then June was kind of a breaking point. And by this point I had gone back to church. I probably went back to church in May or so, maybe April. But I was dying inside. I was not happy at all. And that year was a very rough year for Mormons on the fringe. When John Dillon and Kate Kelly were called in I just thought, I can't do this anymore. You know, here are these people that are creating a safe place for me. I saw myself in their questions and in their conversations. And I thought, if I just had the voice and the platform that they have, I would be John DeLynn or I could be Kate Kelly. You know, it was really hard for me to see, you know, especially when Kate Kelly was excommunicated, it felt very violent and it felt like a personal attack towards me. And, you know, thousands of us around the world. When Kate Kelly was excommunicated, I think I went one Sunday after that. And then we had already made arrangements to go to Community of Christ has a reunion tradition, and it's kind of like a ward camp out, but it's a larger regional thing. And so people come from the larger area, and they had a camp out in Ogden. And so we had decided that we were going to go to the tail end of that. And that was going to be my first experience with Community of Christ. And I thought, like, okay, you know, I'm just going to go to a camp out. How churchy can it be? You know, like, it'll be good. And so I knew that we were going to be gone the next week. And the week after Kate Kelly was excommunicated, you know, it was that Sunday, and I was sitting in church just dying. I mean, I don't remember anything about what was said in sacrament meeting or anything. Josh was at work. I had three little kids, a newborn baby, you know, three-year-old twins that were going nuts. And I just thought, what am I doing? I'm showing so much devotion to this church, and nobody has known how much I've been struggling for years and years and years. And they just kicked Kate Kelly out like it was no big deal. And I had heard people in my neighborhood say very hurtful things about her. And I heard people in my family say these things. And I had never met Kate Kelly at this point. You know, she wasn't like a personal friend of mine, but it was what she represented that was so important to me. And so to hear all of these really, really unchristlike things be said towards her, it was really hard to not take personal. And so that last Sunday, after she was excommunicated, I was done. I mean, there was no sense of nostalgia when I would think about the church. There was no sense of loyalty. It just felt like I had been kicked in the face and, you know, kicked to the curb, which sounds really dramatic, but that's what it felt like.
Yeah.
Well,
and you just mentioned that you some of your family had said things about the more progressive movement and had not been supportive, and specific derogatory comments about Kate Kelly's efforts. How does your departure from the tradition, how has it impacted some of those relationships? And how did you first talk to your extended family about the break, which I'm assuming you've done now? I don't know that you have or haven't.
Yeah, no, we have. It was rough. So we started attending Community of Christ. I mean, I fell in love with it pretty instantly, and I kind of had thought, you know, after the first week or two, maybe I would go to the LDS ward when Josh was home on Sunday or was at work on Sundays. And then when he was home and able to go to church, then we'd go to Community of Christ together. But I instantly fell in love. It just kind of solved all of my problems. And it was a safe place where I could question and say these things that I'd been too afraid to talk about from the time I was a little girl. There was a safe place for those questions and explorations and people who understood me. And so we made a pretty clean break. We emailed our bishopric and we said, you know, we're not leaving the church, but we need a break. We're going to explore this. Please release us from our callings, from our visiting teaching, our home teaching. But that's as loud as we got about it. I was very, very careful to not mention it to anybody. And I was absolutely terrified for people to find out. And I think because Facebook is Facebook, you know, different things that, you know, we would like or comment on would suddenly pop up into our family's
feed. It outed you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we were trying to be really careful
freaking
about it.
Zuckerberg.
Right. So it was, so we would kind of get questions and, you know, our all of our family virtually, you know, except for a sibling here or there, or cousins here or there, are very LDS. And so, you know, we would get kind of pushback from my in-laws and then pushback from my family and lots of questions and, you know, pleading to stay LDS. And they were very concerned about us kind of attending both churches at the same time to kind of give it a fair, you know, fair comparison, which I thought was a little bit silly just because, you know, I'd spent 26 years as an LDS person. Right. And so I felt like I knew it and we had really studied it, you know, for the last several years. So I'm like, I know more about some topics of the church than you do, like historically, you know? So, I mean, that was kind of hard to not like get arrogant about it and want to like fight back when, you know, they're telling you this thing that, you know, is not necessarily true or, you know, especially because there's a lot of misconceptions about Community of Christ. And so that was kind of hard when those would start filtering in. And I was just like, no, you don't know what you're talking about, actually. But hey, look, I'm friends with this apostle. Like, you can talk to them, you know, because the church is small enough and approachable enough that, you know, you really can get answers from the top leadership. And so there was just a lot of new cultural things that we were being introduced to that was just really exciting. So it was one of, you know, the best time of our lives, but at the same time, it was hard because we had to be so quiet and tiptoe around people's feelings and just be really careful about it. So it was, yeah, a time where we were trying to learn how to be authentic, but then like lying about being authentic. So it was just this, right? It was a weird dance, but.
How does that work with mom and dad?
Yeah, that's hard because, you know, you are essentially breaking up their eternal family.
Right.
And I would have to remind myself, you know, that what their church teaches and what they truly believe, like, there really is not a lot that we could do that would be worse than what we're doing.
Right.
And it's a huge death and a break in the family. And so sometimes that would make me even more upset at the church. And I felt like I really do feel like I was neutral and I tried really hard to not lash out against the church and just remain positive about what was happening in Community of Christ. But then sometimes, you know, it would just the guilt and the tears that would come. And it just was really hard to know that it's because of you, you know, that's why your mom is staying up all night and crying, you know, that you're the cause of that. Right. So there was just a lot of guilt and I had a lot of self-doubt, not necessarily in the decisions that we were making. But I guess maybe in the decisions we were making, you know, it just, it made you question, is it worth it? You know? And I wasn't looking for another true church, you know, I was just looking for a safe community. And it was hard for me to not get that validation from the people that I loved most of, you know, we're happy because you're happy. You know, that's really all I wanted.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, yeah.
So in the middle of this, you continue going to your Community of Christ congregation. What do you experience there?
Oh, it was so good. It was good because it was first and foremost a safe place. Community of Christ does not have an agenda to, you know, baptize everybody on their second visit. It's very much, your journey is very much led and directed by you personally. And we had very key leadership from World Church who are very much involved with Salt Lake. And the increase of inquiry from Latter-day Seekers, people who were coming out of the LDS faith, has been huge here. And so we had President of 70, Robin Linkhart, was our pastor for several years. And so it was good to have someone who was that strong and visible, and for me, a female, because again, that's all I ever wanted was just to hear the gospel from a female. And so it was really good to be able to have a safe place with no agenda. We knew that we could just stop going whenever we needed to and that they would love us still the same and that they just hoped that we would be spiritually whole wherever we were at. And so, and I mean, that's the message of the church, you know, the worldwide church. And so it was kind of hard because, I wanted to share what we had found with, you know, so many people. And we had, an apostle come over to dinner at our house one night, and we tried to share that with our family. And we thought, you know, we have an apostle from our church coming over. I mean, how cool is that? Like, we're not even members yet, you know, like come and ask him questions and, you know, and it was just seen as a threat to them. And so, all of these things that we were celebrating were still seen as a threat. And so, I mean, things like financial transparency. I remember one of my first weeks there, we had a business meeting and there was this great debate over, you know, well, it's actually not really a great debate, but there could have been a great debate. We were all so new that none of us wanted to debate, but about windows, replacing windows in the church. And, you know, there was a full budget of how much money the congregation's bringing in and how much is coming out and how much we think we should allot to these windows and should this really be something that we should do? And the whole time I just sat there thinking, like, you know, the window's broken. Why are we having a conversation about this? Like, let's fix the window, you know? But it's important enough to have the congregation be that part, like that ingrained in the decision-making process. And I was completely blown away by that. You know, you don't get that in an LDS ward at all. So, I mean, there was little things like that, you know, the female leadership, financial transparency, you know, things like common consent are actually taken seriously. But then there was, you know, bigger theological things that really appealed to us too. You know, biblical scholarship is explored and celebrated. And so you can say, you know, like, hey, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John didn't write Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Let's explore this further, you know, and really look into that and be honest about, you know, what we know about the Bible and what we know about the Book of Mormon and the Doctrine and Covenants and, you know, the early experiences of the saints. And so I've described it as, I felt like my whole life I had been taught, you know, if my grandparents divorced, my whole life I had been taught my grandpa's side of the story. And I'd heard, you know, and believed his side and trusted in his side and took my family line through his side. And then suddenly I was faced with the wife's side of the story, you know, and seeing things from her perspective and what could become of my family if I just leaned into, you know, that other narrative a little bit more. And it really made the whole restoration into something beautiful. And I found beauty that I had lost long, long ago. And so, really, Community of Christ saved religion for me completely.
And I don't know that we can guess at your husband's problems, but you said some of his issues were about foundational restoration principles like the historicity of the Book of Mormon, et cetera. And the Community of Christ, you know, traces itself back to the same roots. You know, like you said, it comes through a little bit different channel through Emma and Joseph Smith, his son, Joseph Smith III. How does your husband feel satisfied by the origins now, or how does that get dealt with?
I mean, yeah. So one beautiful thing about Community of Christ is that history doesn't define our theology. And so you kind of have this broad spectrum over belief and literalism and things like that. For the most part, I think that Community of Christ leadership really embraces scholarship, and they take, you know, the phrase learning out of the best books seriously. And so if there's something that challenges their faith, in studying Community of Christ history, and I've seen them over and over again let that challenge their faith, and they embrace those things, and I think that there's very key moments in, you know, history where they have maybe taken a different step that the LDS Church has necessarily taken. So it's interesting, you know, all of this, quote, new Mormon history that the LDS Church has come out, you know, in these recent essays are things that have been openly talked about in Community of Christ since the 60s, you know, and it's just like, it's not, I mean, my husband can say, you know, and I can say that I don't think that the Book of Mormon is an ancient text, that the Nephites and Lamanites existed, but there can be people in your congregation that can have very traditional grounded testimonies that did happen, that the Lamanites and Nephites were real, and I'm not going to try to convince them that they're wrong, and they're not going to convince me that I'm wrong, you know? So there's just this the sense of community is greater than our need to tell each other that we're right or wrong. And they actually have a document called Faithful Disagreement that goes over that, you know, we can still worship in community while disagreeing with each other, because our relationship and our relationship with God is more important. So he's fine with it. I mean, he finds a lot of satisfaction. I think, you know, there might be some more traditional conservative congregations that, you know, are pocketed in there that maybe we would bump into some different opinions. And I mean, you know, it comes up on Facebook every once in a while, but I mean, it's nothing like, you know, how it was sitting through an LDS Sunday school class for him at all.
Yeah,
so.
Thanks. I was just curious about how that would play out.
The question that I want to ask next, I just like to take the story a little more to completion, if that's okay, is at what point do you join Community of Christ?
Yeah.
So we joined this last January, so a year ago. So we joined in January, and it was about 6 months after we started attending, and we immediately jumped in and we got involved very quickly. That's one thing about Community of Christ, is you don't necessarily have to be a member in order to, you know, start teaching or, you know, just being involved, praying in church and things like that. And so we got involved pretty quickly, which was good. It's continued, you know, through the year. And my husband and I ended up being presented with a call to priesthood this past August. And he actually got ordained on February 14th, and I'll be ordained in April. So it's kind of been this wild ride that, in some respects, I feel like has happened really, really fast. But I think when you know the full story and how much things were bubbling and things like that, for us and developing behind the scenes, it really has been a long journey that has come a long way. So
if I can just kind of summarize and then ask you a final question or two. So like, you started off your story and, you know, you have this very happy childhood in Provo, but at the back of your mind, there are these few questions, and at least a lot of the early questions you indicated have to do with women or the role of women or the role of the divine feminine. And now perhaps within 2 months, you find yourself in a position of being ordained to which office?
We'll be a priest. I'll be a priest.
Okay, so in within 2 months, you're going to be ordained to a priest. How does that feel to kind of make this very long journey and have gender be some kind of at the heart of some of your issues, both in a temporal sense and in an eternal divine sense, and then to finally come through? It seemed like getting ordained seems like coming through to the other side of that to a certain extent. What does that feel like?
Crazy. It was actually really hard for me to accept my call to priesthood. I guess that people thought that I left the LDS Church over female ordination. So part of me felt like I was proving everybody right by, you know, accepting a call to priesthood within a year of joining Community of Christ. Mm-hmm. So part of me wanted to just say no, just to not prove everybody right. And I also realized that I just had deep, deep insecurities. I mean, when you're told your whole life that you have no room at the table, that there's no place for you, in ordination or in ministry, like that's not even a thing, to suddenly have it be a thing. It was really hard for me to accept that for myself, which is ironic because when I was young, I really looked up to this seminary teacher that I had. And I thought, you know, maybe I would want to grow up to be a CES teacher like her someday. And so it was almost maddening. And I was really frustrated with myself for not just jumping for joy and being able to, you know, claim this call right away. But it took a while, and I'm still actually working through it. It's still a lot of times, you know, I'll think about it and I'll have well-meaning comments by people who, you know, will just say like, oh, it's everything you ever wanted. And I just want to say, no, it's not. Like, what are you talking about? I didn't set out to be ordained. Like, this was not what my end goal was. And so I don't know, I kind of get defensive of that a little bit. And it's not something that I didn't seek after it. I'm not like power hungry. I think that that's a very big misconception with women that want to go into ministry. And I just think it's a double standard because, I mean, you can have a Mormon man that, you know, maybe not out loud, but I mean, how cool would it be to be a 70 in an LDS, you know, experience? Like every guy, you know, like if you're devout, like that's a thing that you want, like you'd hope to do, you know, that's something that is like on your Christmas letter home, you know, you brag that your husband's in the bishopric, you know, I mean, it's just something that people take honor in. But yet if a woman says, oh, maybe I'd like to serve the sacrament or communion, you know, suddenly it's like, oh, well, you're power hungry. You know, and so I was dealing with a lot of insecurities. I'm still working through them. But overall, I think of the brave women and men in Community of Christ history that have made this experience possible for me. And I get chills whenever I hear about the World Conference that Wallace B. Smith announced this revelation and hearing the stories of how it broke apart families and it fractured congregations and it broke a lot of hearts makes me even more appreciative of what he brought to the church and for the women and men who helped him along that journey. And then, so I guess to be asked to participate in that 30 years later is just incredible. And it's something that I take very seriously. And so it's been hard for me to, really envision myself in this because I don't have a lot of, are really any role models of what this should look like, you know, from someone at my stage in life. I'm still a young mom of three kids and still very new to this. And but it's exciting. And I think that the church is at a really exciting point in history where those of us in my generation really do have the opportunity to step up and get involved in things really fast. And so I'm anticipating maybe going to seminary this fall through Community of Christ program through Graceland University. And so, it's something that I feel very strongly about, but there still are those deep, deep insecurities that I have. And I don't really like talking about it a lot to my LDS friends and family because it's not something that they appreciate or find validity in at all. But it means so much to me. And so it's still just kind of this awkward dance of learning how to be authentic, but then protecting your heart and protecting these relationships that you have with people who are just not in the position to be happy for you about it. So
thank you, Brittany, for answering that. I think that's actually kind of a nice place to end.
Yeah, perfect. And the only thing I ever say at the end is we'd like to give you the last chance to have your final word. If there was something you had thought that we might ask you about or that we didn't get to that you'd like to say, we give you the chance to say it now.
Well, I don't know. I guess that I just would say that I resonate with a lot of the episodes so far on faith transitions. And I think that we're all of us that come out of the LDS tradition, we can relate to each other a lot. And I don't think that there's one right way to navigate a faith transition. You know, I have friends who've completely stepped away from religion, friends who are still making it work within the LDS faith. But I mean, I do have to put a plug in for my church. And I think that Community of Christ is doing amazing things in the world. And I think that, you know, even if you're not looking for a new church, especially if you're in Salt Lake, like come say hi. We're there every week and we have new people coming in and it's been a really good place for people to just land temporarily. And sometimes they stay forever like myself. But I think at the end of the day, you just need to be authentic and follow where your heart is and where your heart sings and what brings you closest to God, or, you know, the universe or Mother Nature, whatever you want to believe in, or even just yourself. I think finding your own voice and your own power, and learning to not be stifled by fear and the things that are around you, is something that I'm continually working on. But that in the moments that I do succeed in it, they're some of the most joyous moments of my life. So,
yeah, fantastic. Yeah. Thank you.
And thank you.
Beautiful summation of kind of our goal for our project here with this Faith Transitions. Whatever your story, wherever it takes you, we certainly want to hear it. And we know that, you know, whether you resonate toward Brittany needing to go, then hopefully the voices that have shared that strength and courage are helpful to you. And those who decide to stay within the faith tradition that they're in, whatever that might be, that the voices that share that are helpful to you out there. So appreciate that, Brittany.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks again.
Yes, thank you.
Project Zion is sponsored by the Latter-day Seekers team from Community of Christ. The views expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official views of the Latter-day Seekers team or of Community of Christ.